Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/watsonassistant.
This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
Let's go around the horn and say good morning to the guys, and we start with one, Chris Canty. Good morning, Chris Canty. How are you?
What's up, Dave? How you doing?
I'm okay.
All right. Good weekend?
Yeah, I mean, as good as one of our weekends can be, I guess, at this point. Not a ton going on. But everything's fine. You guys are fine. Everything good?
Yeah, everything is good. What do you mean, not a ton going on? We had a bunch of sports this weekend, Dave. We had UFC 249, which was awesome. We had The Last Dance last night. What you mean? It was nothing going on.
Well, I just meant overall. There's not a lot of choices.
Well, I'm just saying, you're probably talking about the best sports weekend we've had in the last 2 months.
Yeah, I guess that's possible. I watched tennis on like some court in the middle of a jungle. Did you see that?
Are you talking about the one I was trying to watch the K show? Are you talking about the one that was on instead of the K show?
Yes. I said on Saturday, I turned on the television to watch the K show on, I guess it was Friday. I don't remember what day they all meld together.
I think it was Friday.
And there was tennis just on a court in the middle of green. And,
well, housing and, development, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like Del Boca Vista, and there was in a chain linked fence was around it. There was one referee, no ball boys, with guys I've never heard of. And Rick, it was so funny because the announcer clearly wanted to, you know, promote what a big event this was. And he says, I don't even remember the guys that were involved. It was a match of two guys I've never heard of. And he says, can you not see to the Coloranos? Can you not see this guy being a top 10 player in the next 3 to 5 years? On the color analyst, he thinks, he goes, no, I can't see that at all. This guy's not even remotely on that level. No, there's nothing I can see.
That actually has been, I mean, between watching that and then watching some of the KBO, I mean, that's actually one of the best things so far to come out of this. Even watching some of the shows that we watch on the Food Network, like the Pioneer Woman's doing, you know, the quarantine editions where she has her kids filming her and they have like, Her pepper, you know, shaker explodes, or she like sets the spoon on fire. Like listening to some of these play-by-play guys, listening to Boog Shambi do one of the KBO games, just because it's so relaxed, because they're doing it from home, just the blatant honesty when he's doing the game and he's like, yeah, I can't wait for this final out. Like he's just done with the game. Like he's so bored by it, he can't wait to be done. I love it. I kind of like it a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit of refreshing honesty. There is nothing shy of refreshing honesty when it comes to Michael Jordan and The Last Dance. We see it in last night. I guess last night was the episode or the two episodes, Rick, that he was a little bit concerned about wouldn't make him look good. And look, he is a guy that at any cost wants to win, and I think that we've seen that in the first 8 episodes, and specifically last night of The Last Dance.
Yeah, I heard a great quote, and this is, you know, going through trying to things, you know, find things to get the guys on my hockey team motivated, to get these kids motivated, trying to go through like all these quotes and everything else. And I'll never forget one of the quotes that I really liked was, on bad teams, no one leads. On good teams, coaches lead. On great teams, players lead. And I mean, I think last night watching those episodes, I mean, that's what Michael Jordan did. And I think it was smart on Phil Jackson's part to kind of realize that if this team was going to be great, when you have your best player willing to lead the way that Michael Jordan was going to lead, that he'd get the best out of everyone around him. But I think, you know, when you see how Jordan reacted at the end of, you know, episode 7 and how emotional he got, I mean, there's a lot of sacrifice that goes into that. Personal relationships, friendships. I mean, that's a lonely place to be, man. I mean, look at who his best friends were. His dad was one of his best friends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's hanging with security guards. And then, I mean, it actually says on, you know, when you watch the show, best friend was his personal assistant.
Right.
I mean, that's who he was closest to. Like, he was willing to sacrifice those friendships, those relationships with his teammates to make sure he would get the best out of them, which in turn, you know, would get the best out of the team and they'd win, you know, win those championships.
But I think that's in part why he got so emotional at the end, though, Rico. Like, he finally broke down and he said, if you don't want to play that way, then don't play that way. I think Michael Jordan cared about his teammates, but he was a little rough on them just because he had to set the bar that high in order to accomplish his ultimate goal, which was competing for championships. He actually went as far as to say it in the documentary. Like, he wanted those guys to win with him. He didn't want to just be the guy that did it by himself. But he recognized that he was going to ruffle some feathers. He was going to be tough on a lot of guys. I mean, listen to him outline the Steve Kerr incident. Like, he talked about it. Phil Jackson calling ticky-tack fouls in practice, and he was upset at Phil Jackson because he thought he was doing the team a disservice by not toughening them up. He said, you're not going to be able to beat the New York Knicks like this. Like, we have to be more physically rugged. And then him and Steve Kerr get into a back and forth, and he ends up punching Steve Kerr in the eye. But I think it shows a lot about who Jordan was from a sports character standpoint, the fact that he called back to the practice facility on his way home that night, got the number for Steve Kerr, called him and apologized, and said that it had nothing to do with him. And you heard what Steve Kerr had to say. Like, Steve Kerr said him and Jordan from that moment on had a really good relationship because Jordan realized, you know, the competitive fire that Steve Kerr had, the intensity that he had, even though he wasn't as talented. He said they never had a problem from that moment on. They had a great relationship. So I think that Jordan was okay as long as he felt like your drive to compete and to win was comparable to him. And if you didn't have that, then it was going to be, in his own words, hell for you. But I think deep down, Jordan cared about all of his teammates. And if you look at it in retrospect, he probably realizes that those guys feel a way toward him, and that's just not how he felt about them.
I'm so torn in watching it because I watch a segment. I'm like, God, what an amazing leader. And the fact that he could take anything and he made stuff up, right? The LeBradford Smith story about how he, at the end of the game, he's like, yeah, good game, Mike. He made stuff up to motivate him. I love that. I love that, you know, he needed new and creative and inventive ways to just drive himself and push himself. I love that. So, like, I'll watch a segment. I'll be like, God, I respect this guy so much. And then there's times when you watch it and they go around to BJ Armstrong or Bill Wennington or whoever. And they're like, yeah, I mean, I don't know what you want me to tell you. He was very difficult. I didn't consider him really to be a friend. Like, all these guys have, they hem and they haw in trying to answer what they thought about Michael Jordan. So, you know, I think it's, I will watch a segment, a scene, and just kind of flip-flop as I watch during the course of any show because I think he's a deep, interesting, fascinating guy.
Yeah, but here's the thing though, Dave. I mean, usually, you know, when you hear comments like this from players as far as their relationship, I mean, if, you know, you just listen to, you know, Bill Wennington or Steve Kerr or BJ Armstrong, who really, I mean, after the last couple episodes comes out as the real winner. I mean, between getting Jordan motivated after celebrating the way he celebrated, all of a sudden he turns it on and then, you know, bringing him back during the Major League Baseball strike to come, you know, see the guys and kind of reignite that fire to bring him back to the team. Those are conversations. Those are questions you'd ask a player about the coach. You know, the great coaches. You know, how do you feel about Bill Belichick? How do you feel about Bill Parcells? You know, when you ask Chris, you know, how did you feel about, you know, Tom Coughlin? Like, and when he goes back and he thinks about it at the time, you know, Tom Coughlin's not easy to play for. He demands the best. Bill Parcells demands the best. And in the moment, you don't really like him. But then, you know, when you take a step back, you realize what he was doing was in your best interest and he got the best out of you. I mean, that's what Jordan did. Like, Jordan was kind of, I mean, he was the best player. And he was also, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, he took on the role as the coach too, to hold guys accountable. Like he was willing to be the bad guy, which a lot of guys aren't willing to do. Scottie Pippen wasn't willing to do it. He led differently, but it wasn't.
Yep.
I mean, it wasn't as effective as what Jordan was doing.
No, it wasn't because it didn't end in them winning a championship, and that's the difference. That's what we're talking about. So at the end of it, Jordan's being emotional and reflecting back on the relationships that he had, and you recognize the cost of winning, the cost of leadership. It cost him some relationships that he might have in place today. He doesn't have those, or at least not to the degree that he should have those based on the success that his teams were able to have. And that's because he was so hard on guys. But I mean, that's what it takes, man. I mean, it's not easy to have that kind of sustained success at the highest level of sports because we keep talking about it. The difference in the margin of talent is not that great. What separates you is your mentality, your discipline, your dedication. I mean, listening to Jordan talk about Scott Burrell. He was like, yeah, Scott Burrell had all the talent in the world, but he didn't have any discipline.
Poor Scott.
He wasn't
Burrell.
Serious. You know what I mean? Like
that boy guy.
Like, think about how curt he was in that description. Like, Michael Jordan didn't pull any punches, and he let Scott Burrell know that every single day, just the way that he talked to him in practice. I mean, that's just one of those things. But Jordan felt like, if I was hard on these guys, if they could stand up to me, then I know they wouldn't wilt under pressure in the playoffs trying to win a championship.
Yeah, I don't think it's, I mean, and Chris, you'll go through this when you have kids, but I mean, Dave, I mean, you have kids. I mean, it's kind of the fine line you walk as a dad, isn't it? where, I mean, you want to get the best out of your kids, and sometimes you feel like you got to be hard on them, and it's
sure.
emotionally it's tough because you want to be their friend. I mean, you want to give them everything that they want or they ask for, but the realization is that you can't. And there'll be times when your kids resent you and they'll tell you they hate you, whatever they end up saying. And I think that weighs on you though, doesn't it? I mean, don't in a perfect world, don't you think Michael Jordan would like to have had the success he had and then have all these
sure.
you know, unbelievable friendships?
If he thought he could have had the ultimate success with you know, sugarcoating things and being easy on these guys, he probably would have done it. But it's got to be, I mean, a heck of a burden to have the team walk on eggshells around you consistently. A lot of the guys respect you, but maybe not like you all that much. And to go out there and score 35, 40 points with 10 rebounds and 8 assists and dominate, you know, game after game after game, that's a hell of a burden he had.
Yeah, it's draining. And I think that's why you see, I mean, as they go back and forth between, you know, between the runs, is that just mentally, and not so much physically, but just mentally, it was enough. Like, he had enough. When you make that decision, and Chris and I always, you know, kind of remind you of this, every time, like Tom Brady, Michael Jordan, these great leaders, Derek Jeter, it's a decision you make every single day, is to be that guy.
Yep.
And for him to do that for as long as he did, I mean, let's not forget, too, I mean, the years before, you know, they started winning championships, and then to go through the 3 win, I mean, between that and then have his dad murdered and everything else,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he was done. Mentally, he just had nothing left in the tank, and he needed that year and a little bit of weight to kind of, you know, reignite that fire.
I also think he walked away from the game because his father did die. And before his father passed, he and his dad talked about going into baseball and trying to pursue that passion as well. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, he told his dad that that's something that he's going to do. And then once he got to that 3rd championship, once he accomplished something that Isaiah Thomas, Magic Johnson, and Larry Bird, his contemporaries, didn't do, then it gave him the opportunity to secure his legacy and then go into that foray with baseball. And that was something that he promised his dad he wanted to do. Like, he and his dad passing, I think, led to, in part, him deciding, you know what, I'm going to do this. I told my dad I was going to do this, and I'm going to fulfill that. I'm going to, you know, go ahead and go into that because I've earned the right to do that. You know what I mean? Like, it was just one of those things that, for him, he even said it in a documentary, like, from a basketball standpoint, I had accomplished everything that I thought I needed to accomplish. There was no other challenge. And I think baseball was that other challenge, but him and his dad also shared that common bond, that love for baseball. So I think, you know, his dad passing just pushed him a little further in that direction and allowed him to take a break from basketball.
Now, he wasn't, you know, major league caliber baseball player, but it amazes me that a guy could not really play baseball. Rick, and you play baseball now, could not play baseball for really 15 years, pick up a bat, train for it, and be even capable of playing at the AA level. It's remarkable and shows you what kind of an athlete he was. And I'm not saying that he was a major league caliber player, because clearly he wasn't.
Yeah, but time out. But time out. I mean, you can say that. Yeah, that's fine. I mean, in reality, is it fair to Michael Jordan that you take him from, you know, NBA superstar and stick him in AA because of the media? No. I mean, AA, I mean, anyone you ask, I mean, that's, you know, of the minor league systems, one of the most competitive. I mean, you're going to get the best prospects from all these teams, for the most part, in AA. So, I mean, he should have started off in, you know.
Yeah, he should have started off in summer league.
Rookie ball. Yeah, rookie ball, single A. And the fact, I mean, he jumps in, and this is something that I thought was interesting last night. No one ever talks about. It's 13-game hitting streak to start.
To start, yeah.
And then all of a sudden he got the Pedro Serrano treatment where they just started him throwing him off-speed pitches that he couldn't hit. But he stole 30 bases. You could see how fast he was. And he drove in 50 runs. I mean, that's not too shabby, man.
I'm not saying he wasn't capable. My point was that to not play baseball for 15 years and to come back and play at the AA level, which, you know, is a high brand of baseball, and to be capable and competent just shows you the kind of athlete that the guy was.
Yeah, he was a freak athlete. And I think the other thing, too, was you see how competitive he is and how competitive he still is. But it was like almost an opportunity for him to continue to be competitive and have, you know, the thrill of the competition, but just to kind of have no expectations, right? Mm. Like, no, he could just be one of the guys. Like, he could go just compete, have fun, enjoy himself, as opposed to, you know, every single day with the media and everyone else just focused on being the best, winning championships.
Like, yeah, he didn't have the burden of having to set the standard for the rest of the guys in the locker room. Like, he just didn't have that. Like, Dave just talked about it a little bit earlier, but he didn't have to worry about all of those expectations. He didn't have to worry about it being, you know, championships being the focus of it. Like, he could actually just go out there and enjoy the game. And, you know, that was something that a lot of people are critical of him for, because they felt like he was taking something away from them by not playing basketball. And I just think that was one of those things where he had earned the right to do whatever he wanted to do. And Jerry Reinsdorf thought as much, because he continued to pay him his bull salary while he played in Double A. So I just think that was one of those things that people unfairly criticized Jordan for. And he had every right to do as a player and as a person. Like, clearly he needed a break. He was burnt out. You can see how intense a competitor he was. Like, that's a lot for any person. And so he had to take a step away from it, especially with what he was dealing with away from sports in his personal life. So I just think that was one of those things that people unfairly criticized him for. And I thought it was wild that people in the media were jumping to the conclusion and trying to connect his father's death with his gambling, and that's the reason why he walked away from basketball. I thought that was wildly inappropriate.
That was a big deal at the time. A big deal. I don't know if you remember at the time that this is the reason that he left the NBA.
No, I do remember it, Dave. Yeah. I just think that was completely inappropriate. I mean, we heard Andrea Kramer
based on no documentation whatsoever.
Yeah, she was like, well, if you connect the dots, you can understand why somebody would come to that conclusion. And I was sitting there thinking while I was watching it, what dots are there to connect? There are no dots. I mean, we heard grumblings about Michael Jordan's gambling, but I mean, him gambling $50,000 ain't the same as us gambling $50,000. Michael Jordan was at another level financially. So, I mean, I just, to say that his problem, his addiction led to his father's untimely death, that's a hell of a leap to make.
It really is.
Especially if you're a responsible journalist.
Well, it's kind of gross when you think about it. I mean, unless you have some actual factual evidence here, how can you come out with unless it's purely conjecture, which is also kind of gross, right? I mean, how do you can't just come out with something like that.
Oh, you can't.
Well, you had that. No, I mean, you had that, and then you had the other theory was that this was an 18-month suspension that was kept under wraps. Like, this is he was going to get suspended, or he could walk away from basketball and go do whatever he wanted to do, and he chose baseball. Which is, I mean, you think about it, is ridiculous, because you're talking about the greatest player of all time. I mean, what he's done for the NBA, that you're gonna suspend him? Really?
Well, what would be the point of that? Like, you would think that if you're gonna suspend him, you'd want it to be known that you've suspended the guy, not to have him.
Because you don't want to embarrass him. I mean, the whole point is you don't want to embarrass him. Right? Like, I mean, he's the golden goose. You're not gonna, I mean, the same reason why, I mean, you think that Adam Silver would want to suspend LeBron James?
Of course not.
Okay. So, I mean, that's, I mean,
but wouldn't you? I mean, if he's the golden goose and you know what he's doing for the game, wouldn't you almost turn a blind eye and just let him continue along and not in quotes suspend him for 18 months quietly?
Well, it'd be out of sight, out of mind. Like, if there was something to that, then he'd be out of sight, out of mind. You'd forget about it, and then people wouldn't start continue to dig into it. I guess would be the mindset.
I guess I don't know the whole.
Well, just the reason why people were trying to connect dots, I would imagine, is because it doesn't make any sense. Like, you'd have a hard time wrapping your mind around, how a guy coming off of three championships, establishing himself as the greatest of all time, team still, the favorites to win another championship would just walk away. People can't make sense of that.
Right. Well, yeah, it looked like at the end of 93, he had nothing left, though. Like, he was completely emotionally and physically spent and had nothing left to go continue to play basketball.
Yeah, but people don't know. People can't. I mean, there's no empathy for an athlete that says, I'm just, it's just mentally I can't take it. But regular people can't wrap their mind around that.
Yeah, but clearly this guy is different from a mentality standpoint than anybody else. And so we're trying to assign a level of logic based on our perspective, but that doesn't work when you start talking about what goes through the mind of the most dominant athlete on the face of the planet. And I'm not saying, and I get why the conversation goes in this direction, because he was on top of the world. Why would he leave at this point? But clearly his mind doesn't work like everybody else's.
Mm-mm.
Otherwise he would be like everybody else. So I just think, when folks are trying to, look at this situation and understand why he did it, you almost have to take what he says at face value, just because we're not capable of having that type of intensity when it comes to anything that we do, like Michael Jordan. We just, most people don't have that.
I don't think you can. I almost think it's impossible to have that level of intensity every single day with everything you do. I mean, you saw at the end of the, what was it, the, when they lost to the Magic and his trainer said, all right, you know, you want to get back at it 2 months, 3 months. He said, tomorrow. Like, the, no, people don't do that. People that you saw when they were filming Space Jam and how he would have these unbelievable pickup games after filming all night and then waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Like, it's not normal what he was able and the way that his mind worked. It's just, it's not the norm, Chris.
It's not the norm, Dave, but sidebar, how about Warner Brothers building a gym, full court basketball with workout equipment on the studio lot? That's awesome, insane.
Huh? Well, that's what you get when you're Michael Jordan.
But then Reggie Miller was talking about it. He's like, he didn't know how Jordan did it. Like, he's got a 6 or 7 a.m. call time to shoot Space Jam, and then he plays pickup basketball for 3 hours in the evening, and then he works out after that. Like, people couldn't figure out how he did it. Like, it's unbelievable, but, I mean, that just shows you how driven Michael Jordan was. And really, he didn't care what anybody else thought.
No.
Like, it didn't matter what everybody else thought to him. Like, it was just like, okay, here's my goal, here's my objective, and I'm going to accomplish it, hell or high water, whatever it does to the personal relationships with my teammates, personal relationships outside of basketball, it doesn't really matter. This is my focus, and this is what I'm going to set out and accomplish, and nobody or nothing is going to get in my way, not even shooting this movie for Warner Brothers. That's not going to get in the way of me and my quest to get back to the top of the sport. It's unbelievable.
See, that's what makes it most impressive watching this documentary, is that it's one thing if just like regular people don't understand. But I mean, the fact that, you know, you're talking about some of the greatest basketball players of all time, they don't understand.
Like,
they don't
get it. How could you understand this?
Well, you can't. I mean, that's why this documentary is must watch television. Try to get in the mind of someone like Michael Jordan into like actually, you know, what goes through his mind, you know, trying to motivate himself every single day. I will say this, though. One of my biggest takeaways from those two episodes was, does he actually win 6 championships if he doesn't walk away for that year and a bit?
If he plays 94 and 95?
If he just continues on, like everything's okay, doesn't take that mental break, does at some point he just break down to the point where he never gets it back?
Could. I mean, and then there's a lot of people that say, oh, they would have just won 8 straight championships and walked their way, you know, those 2 years that he missed and the 3 years on the back end. We don't know.
I don't know if somebody mentally that tough was going to break. I'm uncomfortable saying that. You know what I mean? The toughness that he displayed, even going back to those playoff series where he lost to the Pistons, just like the level of physical and mental toughness, the ruggedness that he had, I just think that Michael Jordan was one of those guys that if he was going to be on the court, he was going to try to cut your throat. And there was nothing or no one that was going to get in the way of him doing everything that it took in order to win. You know what I'm saying? Like, there was a learning curve when he made that jump from college to the pros. And after he took his lumps, once the Bulls got that thing turned around, once he set the standard, I just feel like that was going to be it. Like, there wasn't going to be any drop off until he decided that he was just going to walk away.
Really, watching him is one of the most unbelievable, you know, television things I've ever seen. 800-919-3776. People lined up, want to talk about The Last Dance. Let's get to it. Let's start out with Spike in Jersey. Spike, our friend, you're on 98.7 ESPN.
Happy Monday to everybody. I hope everybody had a good Mother's Day. And I watched that. I have not aged well when I saw some of those guys. Let me tell you. First of all, B.J. Armstrong looks 8 years old.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous, and Michael looks great. But when they mentioned the Bradford Smith, it brought me back. Shows you how much I miss hoops, and you guys know I'm a hoops nut. The Bradford Smith team at Louisville had Purvis Ellison on, who might have been the last senior to be the number one pick in the draft, and they had two other guys that had NBA careers with Kenny Page and Felton Spencer. You remember those names? And that was the Denny Crum team, and that team did nothing. And it goes to show you how college basketball has changed. When's the last time a senior was the number one pick in the NBA draft? I mean, that team's 1990, maybe, 89, 90. And you see a guy go off. It shows you one guy, and they said it in this magnificently edited composite of Michael Jordan. I couldn't believe, I hated him. Dave and I talk about this all the time, Sanders. I can't stand him, but boy, was he great.
He was.
And the motivational stuff was off the rails. You get a guy like that on a team, he's going to take no crap from anybody, and it showed you. It showed you. As much as it hurts me to see him, I revel in how great he was. I mean, unbelievable. Who cares if he was a good guy? His team won 6 championships. He could have won 8. I'm saying now, you'll never know, but he could have won 8 championships. I just wish this thing wasn't over in another couple of weeks, you know?
Next week, I think, is thanks for the call, Spike. Next week is the last one, and it's true. I mean, this guy won at all costs. He didn't care if you liked him. He didn't care if you respected him, but you were going to go out there, and you were absolutely going to take care of business so that he had the best chance to win.
That's the part that probably makes me respect him more, Dave, the fact that he didn't care what you thought about him. He didn't care how you felt in that moment. He was going to try to get the best out of you if you were his teammate, and he was going to try to expose you if you were his opponent. Like, it just didn't matter to him. Like, the game and winning is all that mattered to him. And it's hard for me not to respect somebody that has that kind of single-minded focus, because that's so hard to do. Think about today's basketball player, man. We talk about it all the time, how much guys hear the noise, how they're affected by all of the criticism and stuff, and they feel the need to respond. Michael Jordan, the only response you got from him was his performance on the court. He really didn't have a lot of things to say in the media or to anybody else. It was how he played the game that was his response to anything that anybody had to say about him, good or bad. How could you not respect that?
There just aren't many people. I mean, there just aren't many people walking this earth that are equipped to do what he was able to do.
No.
Or that would want to take on that. I mean, would want to take on that burden. I mean, just go back to, I mean, one of the first things I thought of watching that last night was, you know, watching that Troy Aikman football life, how mad he was when Jimmy Johnson
had to be that guy. He was forced to be that guy.
Exactly right.
Yep.
That wears on you. I mean, you're so, you know, you want as an athlete, you want as much of the distraction, as much of the burden, you know, off your plate. So you can just be there, single-minded, focused on what you're doing. And he was able to, you know, not only be the best, but, you know, hold all his teammates accountable. And let's not pretend, too, like Phil Jackson didn't know what he was doing, calling ticky-tack fouls.
Oh, Phil knew exactly what he was doing. Phil
knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, Phil was a master manipulator, I think it's fair to say. Right? He knew all the right buttons to push, Chris?
Oh, 100%. 100%. I thought it was interesting, though, when Jerry Reinsdorf told Jordan that he had to have the conversation with Phil before he walked away. He had to tell him that he was retiring, and what Phil had to say to MJ. He was saying that, like, you know, a lot of people feel like you're taking something away from them, but that he understood. It almost feels like Phil was like, you're taking something away from me. Like, I got an opportunity to coach what will be known as the savant of this generation basketball players. And you're taking that chance away from me. Like, I don't, like, he didn't know that Michael Jordan was going to come back eventually. Nobody knew that. So, I mean, Phil Jackson was probably looking at the finality of that and saying, you know, this is something that was going to hurt him. This is something that's going to make him feel away. Now, yeah. I'm glad that Jordan was eventually able to come back. But, I mean, think about that, Dave. If you only had those 3 championships from Michael Jordan, I mean, think about how much greatness that we wouldn't have had the chance to witness.
You're right. I mean, and he was how old when he retired the first time? That was after the 93 season. So he was, what, 32? I mean, certainly not an old guy by any stretch. Really in the prime of his career.
Yeah, you could argue that the best of Michael Jordan was yet to come.
Yeah. Yeah, you could. I mean, what he did when he returned was as staggering as what he did before he ever retired. All right, 800-919-3776. Now, today on ESPN Daily, The Last Dance gives a new view of Michael Jordan's dominance, but that was the 90s. Would he be the same star now? Hear how Jordan's game would translate to the modern NBA. That's on ESPN Daily. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcast. This argument actually annoys me. Both ways. Would Michael Jordan be capable of being great now? And of course he would. And would a guy like LeBron be capable of being great in the 80s or early 90s? Of course he would. Greatness translates generations. These guys would be great in whatever generation they played. These arguments anger me, Chris.
No, I get why they anger you. I don't like them either. I mean, they have the term all-time great for a reason. LeBron James and Michael Jordan are all-time greats. I mean, they're on the Mount Rushmore basketball. But I guess the thing that I look at when you're comparing greats across different eras is the mentality. And not to say that LeBron James is not a killer, but Michael Jordan is on a whole nother level. Like from his mentality standpoint, like he's on a whole nother level, Dave.
But I think he could be like once in a lifetime. I mean,
agreed.
Guys
agreed.
That make up stories to motivate themselves and you know, I mean, I've never heard or seen, and you guys are professional athletes. Have you ever heard, Rick, of anybody doing anything like this ever?
Yeah, I mean, you've heard stories. I don't know to the degree that Michael Jordan did, or if they were ever as good as Michael Jordan was. I mean, the fact that he's, you know, as great as he was, and he still used, you know, whatever it was, you know, good game Mike or BJ Armstrong celebrating or, George Karl not walking by the table to say hi. Like, that's a different kind of intensity. That's a different kind of, commitment. But, I mean, here's the other thing. Michael Jordan in this era, I mean, I wouldn't be concerned about him. He'd probably be better, but would his teammates be able to handle it?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Would today's athlete be able to handle, you know, being pushed the way Michael Jordan pushed his teammates back then?
I think that's, therein lies the question. I don't know that they would. Rick, I don't know if you saw this was sad news. Jerry Stiller, passed away at the age of 92. His son Ben, tweeted out he was a great dad and grandfather and the most dedicated husband to Ann for 62 years. He will be greatly missed. Love you, Dad. So certainly a long, long, wonderful life, but still, Jerry Stiller passes at the age of 92. That's sad news to wake up to on this Monday morning.
Yeah, not great news. I loved him. You know, he was funny in Zoolander. Like he just had one of those, every time you saw him do something, I mean, you couldn't help but laugh. So yeah. Another sad day just to add to the many sad days that we've experienced so far here in 2020.
Yeah, 2020 has been awful, man.
I mean, it's the worst.
It's been
uncle,
awful,
right?
Man.
Just call and uncle on it.
It's been crazy, man. Over the weekend, we also had Richard Penniman, a.k.a. Little Richard, pass away.
Yep.
And Andre Harrell, Uptown Records. I mean, he's the one that found P. Diddy, gave him his shot. So, I mean, we're losing so many people that contributed to the culture, man. It's been a rough year, man. I'm ready for 2021 already.
If
we're talking about May and I'm ready for 2021.
Right? If you could fast forward right now, Chris, and just wake up and have it January 3rd, 2021, you would do it tomorrow morning?
100%, Dave.
Yeah.
And not feel like I was missing a whole lot.
Because you're not.
Thinking about that.
what would you be missing?
I'm willing to give away 7 months of my life just so I can get out of this nightmare that is 2020.
Yeah, this is some kind of year, 2020. All right, speaking of 2020, this is a read for the year. There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you're sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and 98.7 ESPN New York. Rick, did you see who's going to be on the K-Show today at 5:30?
I haven't. Who's going to be on the K-Show, Dave?
Well, why don't you take a guess who it might be? Someone write up your – I ask you specifically because I think I mean, Chris will be interested, but I think you'll be more interested in this guest.
Gary Bettman.
No, more of a team that you root for over a team that Chris roots for. A man with a lot of pressure on him this coming season. A lot.
Sam Darnold.
That's correct. Sam Darnold, nice. 5:30 on the K-Show.
Oh, that's, I mean, I have to watch that. Hopefully it's on TV. I don't have to watch tennis in someone's backyard, but.
In the middle of the jungle.
That was not that. It's like a housing development. It looked like it was. Like,
it was just, weird though.
It was weird, yeah. And seeing them like no ball boys, like
no ball boys. They had buckets on the sides. Did you see that?
Yes.
That they would, they were serving. It would be a fault. The ball would be at the net. They just leave it there and do their second serve.
Yeah, I did see it. It was weird. Yeah, it was definitely weird. I can say this. I definitely enjoyed UFC without fans more than I enjoyed the tennis.
Well, the UFC was like legitimate fighters, though.
Yeah, it was legitimate fighters.
Right.
Even the prelims. I mean, there were people that fought that weren't. I mean. The pay-per-view was great, but even the prelims, I enjoyed.
So
how was Anthony Pettis, Cowboy Cerrone, a prelim and not on the pay-per-view portion? Unbelievable, man.
How was Anthony Pettis standing up after he took that shin to the side of the head?
That's a great question.
These guys are unbelievable.
I mean, Tony Ferguson took a beating, though.
Beating.
He took a beating. First it was the left hooks by Gaethje, and then it was the right hooks.
Then it was the kicks.
I don't know how Tony Ferguson lasted to the fifth round. I don't know how it wasn't stopped before that.
Yeah, that was one of those fights where even in losing, he earned so much respect in that fight. Getting as far as, I mean, he broke his orbital bone too in that fight. Getting as far as he went. Because he hit him. I mean, he hit Gaethje with that uppercut in the end of the second round.
End of the second, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
They went uppercut to uppercut, and he hit him with it first and saved by the bell.
But when that left hook caught Tony Ferguson early in that third round and that right eye started to swell, that's when I knew the fight was, like, it was no longer in doubt at that moment. You were just waiting for the moment where Gaethje would put Ferguson out of his misery. But you didn't see Gaethje get wild, you know what I mean, to try to finish him. Like, he was still composed, and he ended up getting the stoppage in the fifth, but he didn't expose himself trying to finish off Ferguson, which I thought was impressive. Like, you're going to need that kind of discipline against somebody like Khabib.
Yeah, I think everyone said it. I mean, he fought the perfect fight. I mean, he did exactly what he needed to do.
All right, let's get back to the last answer. We'll get right back to the UFC 249 in the 11 o'clock hour, 800-919-3776. Let's go to Monty in Woodbridge. Monty, you're next up on 98.7.
How you doing, guys? I just wanted to call in. I don't have a problem with Jordan's mentality whatsoever. I think one of you guys touched on it. It's like, it's really interesting because it's like looking into a mind of like a genius, you know, and I think, you know, having kids myself, you know, if any one of my kids, developed a focus on something that he wanted to do, whether it be a lawyer or a teacher, and he wanted to be the very best, and, you know, he kept a small group of friends, never committed any crimes, I think anybody, you know, if they were able to get that type of attitude from their from one of their children, they would take it in a minute because, it's hard to do. It's hard to remain that focused without being distracted by a lot of social, you know, a lot of different people that come and go. And I think it was harder for Jordan to even be, you know, so focused and just nice at the same time to fans and even other teammates and other people around the league. I think that was difficult enough, and I don't think he gets credit for that. I don't think that's talked about enough either because, you know, where he was a jerk at times, he was also very nice, you know, and, to be that much of a, you know, for lack of a better word, a genius towards his craft, I think it was a very difficult balancing act.
I'm sure it was. I'm sure, Rick, that it was next to the call, Monty, near impossible to be a guy. And you saw him with the fan in the wheelchair that was in the locker room, and he was kind to him and nice to him and talking basketball with him. But, I mean, he was a savage out there on the court and a savage out there in practice with his teammates.
No, because that's where he needed to be to get the best out of himself and the best out of his teammates. I mean, a lot of what happens to professional athletes that, you know, separates the good from the great is their mentality, is the psychology surrounding, you know, what motivates each player and, you know, how coaches decide, you know, how they're going to motivate their players. And for Jordan, it was, you know, I'm going to push you to the limits in practice. I'm going to make it as hard as possible. And, you know, if you can meet that challenge, like when Steve Kerr, you know, stood up for himself, and then Jordan obviously ends up punching him in the face. But I mean, no, but seriously, like that's when you earn the respect of your teammates.
Well, yeah, because he actually fought back. And he said, I might not be the player that you are. And clearly he wasn't, and he knew that, but I'm not going to let you push me around.
Yeah, I think it's a misconception that good teams don't have any conflict between the players or coaches.
They have the most.
Yeah, they have the most. They just have a way of being able to deal with it, and they prioritize winning, and they don't let anything get in the way of that. Like that last caller said, it was a tough balancing act. I don't think it was a balancing act at all for Jordan. There was no balance. It was winning. That was it. There was nothing else. We are going to win. And it didn't care what it looked like or what it felt like to everybody involved, whether it's teammates, coaches, the GM, the owner. It did not matter. This is what it was going to be. He just hoped that his teammates would be able to enjoy it as much as he did. And based on some of the things that we've heard come out about how teammates feel about him, I mean, you had Craig Hodges last week talking about it a little bit. Like, he probably is a little bit hurt that some of those guys to this day still feel a way about him. Whereas for him, it wasn't a slight or a knock against those guys the way he treated them. It was just what he felt like they needed to do in order to accomplish the ultimate goal.
Yeah, I think, I mean, especially now, I mean, any of these savants, Michael Jordan, Bill Walsh, like, I mean, you watch all these documentaries and you try to get into their, you know, their mindsets at the time. And, you know, as you move, you know, further and further along past it, you start to reflect. And I'm sure Jordan's at a point now where he realizes that, you know, he sacrificed a bunch of really good relationships to get where he got. And I think that's probably why he got so emotional. I mean, that's not easy to deal with, man. I mean, you want to be like you want to be one of the guys. Like, everyone wants to be one of the guys, but you need to realize that, you know, I'm going to have to make some sacrifices. It's like being the lead singer in a band. I mean, you want to go hang out and, you know, spend all hours of the night out with your bandmates, but you can't because, I mean, it's your voice that everyone's counting on, right? Like, you can't afford to all of a sudden go out till 6 o'clock in the morning, drink your face off, and then you can't sing the next day. You're just different. There's a different set of expectations surrounding
you. The same rules that everyone else has don't apply to you, for better or for worse.
But he's willing to accept that. And I think that's why at the end of the first run, he was was the culmination of everything. He was just spent. That was it.
He was. All right. I want to remind you, you can listen to us anywhere you go. Click listen live at ESPNNewYork.com. Find 98.7 ESPN on the ESPN app or the TuneIn app. Or simply tell your smart speaker, play ESPN New York at 98.7 ESPN New York. We go where you go. Story from Adrian Wojnarowski on ESPN. Let me read you the story, then we can react off of it. NBA has reached an agreement with the NBAPA to extend until September the 60-day window that preserves the league's rights to terminate the CBA in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. Pushing back the deadline allows for the NBA and union to gather a clearer picture of the economic losses and bargain on a number of crucial financial issues, including salary cap and luxury tax threshold. The NBA had the ability to terminate the CBA under the force majeure event provision for those 2 months starting on March 11th when the season was suspended. There's optimism that the league and union can work through these issues and agree on how the NBA's financial landscape will be recalibrated on a number of issues, including next season, 2021, the salary cap, the luxury tax thresholds. The extension allows the league and union to continue trying to resume this season, salvaging some regular season games, carrying out the playoffs, recouping some of the lost revenue, obviously. NBA Commissioner Adam Silver told the players Friday that the fans, through gate receipts, concessions, and other game night receipts, constitute 40% of the league's revenue, according to audio of a tape obtained by ESPN. The league would restart the season without fans. And I think that goes without saying. And Silver held out the possibility on this call that could also be possible for the start of next season as well. The NBA and NBPA share revenue on a 51-49 split of basketball-related income. This is all on a conference call on Friday. Quote from the commissioner, the CBA was not built for an extended pandemic, Silver said on this call. There's not a mechanism in it that works to properly accept a cap when you've got so much uncertainty. When we'd be going into next season saying, well, our revenue could be $10 billion, could be $6 billion, or maybe it could be less. So basically, guys, what it sounds like, we'll start with you, Rick, is they just don't know, and this allows the commissioner, the NBA, Adam Silver, to buy himself time to come up with a decision of what they're going to eventually do down the road.
Yeah, they don't know. I don't think anyone knows. But I also think this is, you know, to go back to what we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, is trying to sell to the players the long-term ramifications of what happens if they don't come back. And this is kind of maybe a gentle nudge to them to, you know, really start to think about, you know, what this thing is going to look like if we don't find a way to get back and play, you know, play these games and play these playoffs and you know, award a champion. Like, what is financially, what does that mean? Not just now, but what does that mean for next year and the year after that?
I also think this is the owners not wanting to be the only party in this relationship that absorbs the losses based on what we're going through with this pandemic. Because the one thing we do know with certainty is that they're not going to get the gate receipts, they're not going to get the concessions, and they're not going to get other game night revenue from this season. That's not going to happen. That money is lost. So when you start throwing out a number like 40%, that's a significant amount of income that these NBA teams are not going to be able to recoup. So moving forward, what does our revenue split look like? Like our sources of revenue coming in, and then what is the disparity in terms of what the owners make versus what the players make? And I think because you have that uncertainty, there is the potential for there to be some tension in terms of being able to get this worked out so we can actually resume basketball, if and when we get to a point with this pandemic where it becomes safe enough to do so.
Yeah, I think this is a subtle nudge. I mean, I think the numbers that you're talking about as far as salary caps and, you know, 40% coming with the gate and, mm-hmm. you know, basketball-related revenue, I mean, those are things that, you know, the owners are focused on, not just how much money they'll lose this year, but how much money we could potentially lose, you know, next year. And I don't think players are really focused on that. Like the player, you know, okay, I've been paid for, you know, almost an entire season. I don't get paid for the playoffs. So, you know, I'm going to lose some money this year.
Right.
But then we'll just go back to me making whatever I make, you know, on a regular basis next year, when the reality is you're not. You know, I think the NBA is kind of let the players know, hey, listen, it's not just going to affect you now. Mm-mm. Like this is going to affect you long term too. So, you know, make sure you take that into account when, you know, we give you a proposal that's, you know, obviously it's going to be safe. Health-wise, we'll make it as safe as possible. But, I mean, when you got someone like Shaq saying we should just scrap the season, they cannot afford. Or I mean, they don't want to even broach the idea of all of a sudden scrapping the season because of what it's going to do, especially to next year's season when no one actually knows when. You have no idea when, you know, state to state you're going to be allowed to have fans in seats.
No, and I think what he's saying right now is if we scrap this season, it's not, okay, wash your hands of it. You miss out on, you know, 20 games pay, and then we get back to Christmas Day, and you're going to get your full pay moving forward. Think about where we are now, and if we don't play, there will be a lingering effect down the road for all you players, right? That's kind of what it feels like he's saying.
Oh, yeah, it'd be a forfeiture of the revenue that you would get for the rest of this season. That's absolutely going to affect next year's salary cap. And keep in mind, the NBA owners have the nuclear option at their disposal with the force majeure clause in the CBA. I mean, this is certainly something that would qualify as an unforeseeable event. And so they can at that point exercise that clause, but then you're talking about the relationship between the NBA owners and the NBPA becoming adversarial, contentious. And I don't think that either party wants to go down that road. So this is one of those things they're going to have to walk on eggshells with. But because right now both parties feel like they're within their rights to ask the other party to absorb the brunt of what we're going through from a financial standpoint with this pandemic. That's what this is about. This is about who's going to feel the effects of this financially more than the other one.
Yeah, I think this is just, I mean, this is the NBA owners letting the players know it's not going to be just us. Mm-mm. Like, and the same thing is going to happen with Major League Baseball. Like, we don't care about, you know, whatever you think as far as the agreement we came to. Like, that's not, I mean, it's going to have to be, you know, renegotiated. Because, I mean, if we're not going to be whole, you're not going to be whole. That's not how this thing is supposed to work.
All right, we'll get back into this a little bit later. Very interesting as we move forward here towards the potential start of these seasons. Andy and Merrick, our dear friend who asks us trivia questions every day at this time, you're on. Good morning, Andy, on 98.7 ESPN.
Good morning, guys. I came a little hot at you Friday, so let's see if we can get back to a winning streak here for you, okay?
Yeah, you were spicy like lava on Friday, Andy. You were spicy. I need the mild version today.
What you brought on Friday was seemingly unfair.
All right, well, we'll start with CC. Who was the youngest, and by the way, the shortest teammate on your 2011 New York Giants roster?
Oh.
Shortest teammate.
And youngest. He qualifies as both.
Shortest and youngest on the 2011 roster. I'm thinking running back. Is that right?
He's from Troy University.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Jarrell Jernigan.
There you go.
Yeah, he's a returner. Yeah.
All right, Rick. You ready for me?
I'm ready, brother. Let's go.
All right. Only one player who happened to be a goalie has won the Conn Smythe as the MVP of the playoffs prior to then winning the Calder as Rookie of the Year. Ooh. Can you tell me who that is?
I'm going to go with, and this is a goalie, you said, or the only one was a goalie?
The only one was a goalie.
I'm going to go with, I think he was a Carolina Hurricane. Was he? Is it Cam Ward?
No, let's go a little deeper back in history.
Oh, deeper back in history.
Way back.
Cornell?
So you're going to.
Cornell would be correct.
Mm-hmm. Ken Dryden?
There you go.
Yeah.
There's the bell. All right, Dave, speaking of the Conn Smythe.
Oh, God.
There have been a total of 8 non-Canadians who have won the award. Can you tell me the first non-Canadian to have won that Conn Smythe trophy?
I could use Rick's help. Well, Brian Leetch, I'm thinking.
That is correct.
That is correct. Yes, it is.
I am the smartest man alive.
Brian Leetch back in 94.
3 for 3, right back on track, guys. Stay
that's
healthy.
That's what we do. Excellent, excellent.
Dave, the way your mind works is amazing.
Well, that's like my wheelhouse. I mean, that was Brian Leetch. So I knew he won the Conn Smythe, and I knew he was American. Obviously, I was at every playoff game for the Rangers. So if I had to start going outside of my direct wheelhouse, it could have been a little more trouble.
Okay.
Did you know that, Rick, right off the bat?
Yeah. Yeah. I love Leetch. He's one of my favorite. One of my favorite teammates of all time.
He was a great player.
Awesome player. Awesome. Just as good a guy, too.
I feel we did well there.
No, we did good. I got Fridays right.
We did good. I mean, it's just a continuation of what you did on Saturday with Stunt Rothenberg.
Some of the questions are outlandish, though.
Some of the questions were outlandish. I thought you taking credit for a correct answer on that Greece question was a little bit questionable.
Well, first of all, the fact that someone calls every week with a question about the movie Grease is interesting.
Yeah.
And then he makes it through the call screeners. But, well, he said who was the band in Grease, and I eventually said Sha-na-na.
Yeah, but he asked what was the name of the band. It was Sha-na-na, but that wasn't the name of the band in the movie. I thought that was the question.
No, I don't. Who can remember now?
Johnny Casino and the Gamblers.
Oh, look at you.
Yeah.
I should have called you to phone a friend.
Well, it's just my girlfriend loves Grease. She loves that
really?
Movie. Yeah. I've seen it more than I care to.
Really?
Yes.
And this guy's obsessed with it.
Yeah.
He asked me, I mean, like the real first name of one of the characters the other day.
I'm with you, though. It feels like a strange movie to be obsessed with.
Right. Like if you're obsessed with The Godfather, okay. Very few people, I would think, are obsessed with the movie Grease.
I would agree with that, Dave.
But this man who calls every Saturday seems to be one of them.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg. Weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.